Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Are you ready to lose weight? With Effecty, getting access to powerful GLP-1 weight loss medications has never been easier or more affordable. Effecty offers compounded semaglutide, the same active ingredient as the popular name brands, but for up to 80% less. These medications work by regulating appetite and blood sugar, helping you lose weight in a sustainable, science-backed way. Getting started is so simple. Just fill out a short medical questionnaire, then connect with a licensed provider through a quick chat-based telehealth consultation. If you're eligible, your prescription gets shipped straight to your door. No hassle, no waiting rooms. With transparent pricing, no hidden fees, and no membership required, Effecty is committed to making proven weight loss treatments accessible to everyone. Effecty gave me the opportunity to try their service out, and I have to say it is just as easy as they say it is. I filled out the questionnaire, and within days, a package arrived at my door filled with everything I needed and detailed instructions. Their website also tells you everything you need to know, and you can always chat with your healthcare provider. It really is that simple and convenient. So if you're ready to level up your weight loss game, my listeners can now get $50 off of GLP-1 weight loss treatments at Effecty.com with code ATTWG at checkout. That's Effecty.com, EFFECTY.com, and use the code ATTWG to get $50 off your first month of GLP-1 weight loss treatment. No hassles, no memberships, and no hidden fees. So get started today. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
After facing a lifetime of abuse and instability, 15-year-old Yasmin Akree had managed to become a bright athletic student at Chicago's Austin Polytechnical Academy. She was getting ready to start her first job, and her life was on an upward trajectory. On January 15, 2008, Yasmin went to sleep planning to attend school the next morning. But when dawn broke on January 16th, there were signs of forced entry into her basement bedroom, and Yasmin was gone. Despite the worrisome circumstances behind her disappearance, police initially classified Yasmin as a runaway, and key evidence was overlooked. Evidence including a felon who had taken a particular interest in the young girl. Now, after enduring more tragedy, Yasmin's family is still begging the Chicago police to help them find answers in her disappearance. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Yasmin Akree. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. We are bringing you back to Chicago this week, which is actually fitting because we're coming up on the anniversary of another case that Chicago police have completely bungled, that of Kiara Coles. And, you know, I don't want to get into that here because I don't want to take away from Yasmin's story. And I'm going to have more to say about it over on TikTok because...
Just seems like there's a reoccurring theme with Chicago PD where if somebody goes missing, they just shelf it.
Yeah, it is interesting because Kiara's case is different in that, like, at the beginning, they did really go for it. But then they're like, meh, I don't know. And it's a very... In my opinion, easy case to solve, Kiara's is. So, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but...
Sure, but I mean, even the little bit that you just said, yeah. I have a million questions about... You said it seems as though there's forced entry?
Yeah, forced entry, like intense forced entry.
But they're writing it off as she walked out?
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck?
Well, she was black and, you know, not in a good neighborhood. Yeah, so anyway, like, it's, in my mind, it's not a good week for the Chicago PD, so this case is just so, so upsetting because, you know, you have a story like Yasmin where, you know, she has such a tragic life growing up, and then it seems like she's getting out of it, and it seems like there's some, you know, light on the horizon, and she just has it all taken away. So it's absolutely tragic. Yeah. So, but anyway, I mean, we might as well just get into it.
Yeah.
Yasmin Akree was born on October 25th, 1992 in Kentucky to Joyce Akree. When she came into the world, Yasmin's home was already on shaky ground. Her father was long out of the picture and her mother, Joyce Akree, struggled with substance abuse. Unfortunately, this led to Yasmin and her older brother, DeMarcus, being placed into the Kentucky foster care system when they were only toddlers. And they were only about a year apart, her and her brother, so they were both very little.
Were they kept together?
They were kept together for the most part, it sounds like. I don't know if they were separated maybe for short periods, but for the vast majority of it, they were kept together. Now, what followed, though, were many difficult years full of neglect and abuse for the two children. Throughout their childhood, Yasmin and DeMarcus were continuously sent between foster homes, foster care, and Joyce's home. During this terrible time of constant upheaval, Yasmin's records show that she was not only physically abused, but also sexually abused. This abuse then resulted in her developing emotional and behavioral problems, which often showed up whenever Yasmin tried to make contact with other people.
Do we know who the sexual abuse came from?
I think it was just various like foster families. Now, I do want to say there was a foster family that both Yasmin and DeMarcus lived with for 3 years, right before kind of our story begins in 2001. So they lived with them for the 3 years preceding that. And this family really did want to adopt both kids. And we'll kind of get into why they didn't in a minute. But I don't believe any of the abuse took place there. I think it was just kind of like them bouncing back and forth prior to this.
Yeah, I was just more curious as to whether it was the abuse existed in mom's household.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, that could be a possibility, but that has not been specified.
Okay. Sorry, social worker inside of me.
So the way that this abuse kind of manifested itself in terms of Yasmin's difficulties is that she would often approach other children. And keep in mind, she's so little at this point. But she would approach other children and adults and like didn't understand that the physical contact she was initiating with them was inappropriate. Mm-hmm. So that in turn made making meaningful and healthy relationships very difficult for her.
Right.
As a result, her caseworkers advised that she never be left alone with other children until Yasmin was old enough to understand that her behavior was inappropriate. So, you know, that's tough for a kid.
Yeah, that's also doesn't solve an issue. That's like treating a symptom, but not treating the disease.
No, you know I agree. Like, and I mean,
like, yes, of course. Yeah, like you have to deal with that.
Yeah.
To an extent, but
you have
like,
to do triage, right? Like you can't put other kids at risk.
Right.
But I will, you're right. That doesn't solve the problem.
Right.
Now it was said that her caseworkers obviously recommended, you know, intensive therapy and things like that. I just don't know what types of therapy she actually completed.
Right. And we don't have the whole record. So, you know,
exactly. We just have a very basic overview of like what was recommended over a period of years as well. So you don't know like how many caseworkers
right.
came through, who had what information, right. et cetera, et cetera. Like it's just a terrible place for everybody to be in. And though she tried, Joyce unfortunately never managed to keep things together long enough to officially regain custody of her children. After years of back and forth, Joyce seemed to accept that she wouldn't be able to provide a safe home for them. But, you know, she loved them and she didn't want to see them continue to go through the pain of foster homes and group homes. Now, yeah, there are a couple of ways to look at this. You know, of course, hindsight being 2020, it is tough to know that the kids were with this family for 3 years who did want to adopt them. But it sounds like Joyce was adamant that if she couldn't have her children back, which by this point she's kind of realizing she can, and we're talking about 2001 now, she really wanted them to be with family. She didn't want them to be with this foster family. She wanted them to be with her family. The people in the Kentucky child welfare system like looked into it, and they were able to find a permanent solution. They reached out to, you know, many of the relatives, and they found a woman named Rose Mae Starnes. Rose was the kid's aunt by marriage, and she lived nearly 400 miles away in Chicago's Austin neighborhood, but she agreed to take Yasmin and DeMarcus in.
Let me get this straight. This is a relative by marriage, so not blood related, plus she is 400 plus miles away.
370, but yes.
From where the kids know as their home.
Right.
But they've been with this foster family for 3 years.
Yes. I know. It's a little tough.
It isn't. this person isn't actually blood related to them.
Right. But they did have other family members in the Chicago area. So it's not like they were moving almost 400 miles away to this aunt by marriage and nobody else. They were staying with the aunt, but they had other blood family members in Chicago as well.
I don't know. That just seems really tough to me.
I mean, it was. And it's like how, you know, but in the moment, it just, I'm sure just seemed like the best thing for the children, you know, for them to be with family if they couldn't be with her. And yes, looking back on it, it probably wasn't, but you can't go back. And this move did not turn out to be their fairy tale ending for either kid. Rose later admitted that she was overwhelmed when Yasmin and DeMarcus first arrived. So she had a child of her own who, by that time, I believe was an adult and had already moved out of the home. So she was kind of starting over. And Rose said that when the children arrived, they had terrible manners and Yasmin still had issues with inappropriate physical contact.
Look, I'm sorry, but like, what did you think that you were getting the best kids ever? Like, they've been in and out of the system for basically their entire lives. Like,
yeah,
of course there's going to be behavioral issues that you have to deal with.
Like, it's just tough to go back and look and kind of know the entire situation. But yeah, it seemed bad. So it sounds like Rose owned a building in Chicago that had different like apartments in it, right? And Yasmin and her brother had to share a bedroom down in the basement. And sometimes Rose would lock one or both of them in there as punishment.
They're not going to a better situation. It doesn't sound like it.
It doesn't sound like it. Rose also said that she would sometimes discipline Yasmin by hitting her with a belt. Rose also had a hard time managing Yasmin's brother, DeMarcus. She later described him as, quote, a real mischievous child, end quote, and admitted to whipping him with an extension cord.
Jesus Christ. The kids are going from one bad situation to the next.
The children's Chicago caseworker described Rose as a loving guardian and was apparently unaware of the corporal punishment that the pair was subjected to. Despite the continued abuse at the hands of Rose and her own issues with inappropriate contact with other children, Yasmin eventually did begin to blossom. She turned into a lively, smart, and athletic girl. She did well in school and was even the salutatorian of her eighth grade class. Yasmin was active in her local sporting communities and seemed to be making the most of her circumstances. As she continued to blossom into a happy, healthy, successful preteen, tragedy struck in 2005 when she was 12. Joyce Acree, Yasmin and DeMarcus's mother, was found dead. She was only 47 years old. By this time, Yasmin and DeMarcus had been living with Rose for about 4 years. With the death of their mother, Rose truly was all they had left, so the next year, in 2006, she officially adopted Yasmin and DeMarcus. Though Yasmin was making friends and doing well in school, she still had a lot of unresolved trauma that she seemingly wasn't receiving proper help with. A caseworker would check in on her every month, but it doesn't seem as though Rose was equipped to deal with what Yasmin has been through. Yasmin's early sexual abuse led to her not only having the inappropriate contact with others that we talked about, but it led her to open herself up to inappropriate contact from others. She had low self-esteem and sought out what she felt to be positive connections in unhealthy ways. Yasmin's other relatives continued to worry about her and DeMarcus. Their grandfather, John Lewis, told the Chicago Tribune, quote, "It wasn't a good situation," end quote. He would bring the kids to his Southside Chicago home on the weekends whenever Rose would allow him. But then sometime after September 2005, a new danger was introduced into Yasmin's life. In September 2005, a man named Jimmy Terrell Smith was released from prison after completing a 10-year sentence for attempted murder. He moved into the building located on the 4800 block of West Congress Parkway, where Rose, Yasmin, and DeMarcus lived. He ended up there because his father, an ex-con named Jimmy Lee Hawkins, already lived there. He was close friends with Rose and actually rented a room in the same basement where Yasmin and DeMarcus stayed. When Jimmy's son, who goes by Terrell, moved in, Rose moved father and son into a second floor apartment because she didn't want them to be so close to the children. Terrell was on parole at this time and later said that he was selling drugs in the neighborhood and always carried a gun on him. Despite her apparent desire to keep some distance between Jimmy, Terrell, and the children, the two families often spent time together. Yasmin developed a crush on Terrell, who was about 35 at this time.
And how old was Yasmin at this time?
She was about 13 when he moved in. Now, it's not unusual for a teenage girl to have a crush on, like, an adult man.
Yeah, that's
at all.
Fine.
But what made this dangerous was not only Yasmin's history and mental state,
right,
but the fact that Terrell also took an interest in the young girl.
Of course.
At a Hawkins family gathering, family members who were present told the Tribune that they saw Terrell give Yasmin a beer and stroke her hair. Terrell only lived in the building for a short time, but moving out did not cease the contact between him and the teenager. So like that family gathering, for instance, I think happened after he moved out.
Okay.
So she might have been 14, you know, even 15 at that point, but
still,
obviously still not okay. In 2007, Yasmin lost another layer of protection when Rose kicked DeMarcus out of the house. He was only 16 years old. And she had just adopted him the year before. But this left 15-year-old Yasmin as the only child in the home, alone in the basement. With her brother gone, Yasmin seemed to lose her grip on things. Her grades suffered, and she became more withdrawn. At one point, she wrote a letter to her teachers after she had 3 D's on her report card saying she knew she could do better, and she kind of like outlined what she could do. She's like, I could listen more in class. It was really sad. But then she said, you know, I got the grades that I deserved, which just like really upset me.
At this point, does she have a social worker?
Yeah, she has somebody coming in to check on her once a month.
Are you fucking kidding me? She's living in a basement apartment in an apartment building? I feel like I get to be a little judgmental here because I was a social worker, and like, how the fuck do you come and visit this home quote unquote, and you're like, oh yeah, totally reasonable that this 15-year-old girl is forced to live in a basement apartment by herself. Her brother's been kicked out, incidentally, probably also on that same social worker's caseload, and you're just like, seems all right. There's a felon living here, or there was.
Oh, no, I don't think they knew about that.
And again, this person is not blood related to Yasmin.
Yeah, but I mean, also, you got to think, though, at this point, it does seem as though she did still have a caseworker checking on her every month. However, Rose legally adopted her. So she had all of the legal rights of a parent at this point.
Sure. And
it's different from a foster parent situation.
Yes.
Is my point.
That's fair. If I have your child on my caseload and adopted or not, you're forcing them to live in a basement separate from like a family unit of any kind. That's an issue with me. Like, that's not okay.
Yeah, I think the argument would be that like she lived during the day up with Rose, and then that's just where she slept.
I don't know. That's not okay. Like I would not be okay with that as a caseworker for that. But also, you know what? To be fair, my experience in social work was immediate and not long term care.
Right.
It was immediate issues. Could the child stay in the home or not? So different set of training, different train of thought. But that just seems really fucking dangerous to me. I don't know.
Her grades started to slip after DeMarcus gets kicked out of the house. And, you know, she says that she's going to turn herself around. And true to her word, she does. She pulled herself together and improved her grades. Now, by 2008, she was a freshman at Austin Polytechnical Academy and was excitedly waiting to start a new job. Unfortunately, Yasmin's bright future was about to be cut short. So here's the timeline as we know it. On January 15th, 2008, Yasmin went to school. It was a half day, so she spent most of the afternoon at the North Lawndale YMCA where she was a regular and was often involved in community and sporting events. The YMCA also had a trip planned for later that year that Yasmin was planning on going on and was very much looking forward to. When she came home around 8 o'clock that evening, Yasmin first did a load of laundry before heading downstairs to her bedroom in the basement, where she presumably went to sleep. Now, Rose wasn't in the house herself that day. She'd actually gone to visit her daughter for a couple days, and they went to play the slot machines at the Grand Victoria Casino. But she was due to return the following day, so the 16th. This, however, meant that Yasmin was alone in the home with Rose's live-in boyfriend, Charles Burt. Charles was 58 years old at the time, and he was the last person to see Yasmin as she headed down to her bedroom that evening.
What time?
She got home that night around 8 and then did a load of laundry and then went down. So, you know, between 9 and 10 would be my guess.
And the boyfriend, do we know anything about him?
Nothing at all.
Okay.
The following morning, and I don't know what time, and it bothers me that I don't know what time exactly, Charles reported that he was taking out the trash when he noticed that the lock on the gate that led to the back garden had been cut. The door to the basement looked as if it had been bashed in and forcibly opened. But when Charles had a look inside Yasmin's room, nothing seemed to be amiss.
So you have a lock cut on a gate that leads to their backyard, essentially.
Yeah. And I've seen it described as a scissor gate.
Okay. I don't know what that is. But...
So I think it's one of those metal gates that like folds up and then expands. Oh, you okay. Know?
Sure. Either way, it's a lockable gate.
Mm-hmm.
A lockable gate that they presumably lock regularly mm-hmm. because it was odd for him to see it. That the padlock was... cut.
Right.
Then we have a door leading to the basement. Now, does it lead to the basement or does it lead directly to Yasmin's bedroom?
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure if it led directly into her bedroom or to just the basement.
Okay. Next question I would have would be any type of alibi for Charles?
It doesn't sound like it. I mean, it sounds like his alibi is that he was home and he stayed home and then he got up in the morning to take out the trash and noticed all of this. I mean, I think that's basically a story.
So maybe we'll cover this later when Chicago PD basically shucks this off as like, you know, clearly she just like walked out on her own or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I mean, did they question Charles? Do we know any sense of his timeline before, you know, Yasmin goes to bed, quote unquote?
Nothing that's been publicized.
He's the last person to see her.
Yep.
And his timeline is 8 o'clock.
She gets home, does laundry.
Does laundry, goes downstairs. Mm-hmm. And then the next morning, he sees the signs of forced entry. But then Chicago PD doesn't seem to take that into account.
Well, question
him.
And I don't know how much they questioned him.
Right.
But what's interesting about this is that, like, so he goes into Yasmin's room, sees that the room itself looks normal. Like it doesn't look like, you know, somebody tried to break in and like look for stuff to steal or anything like that. It doesn't look like there was any sort of a struggle with her.
Okay.
You know, if it weren't for the locks and the door and all of that stuff, if he had just randomly gone and looked at Yasmin's room, like it just looked like it would have been any other day. So,
sure.
Now, Yasmin wasn't there, and this is what bothers me about why we don't know what time it is, because everything that I've read says that he just assumed she had gone to school early.
I mean, how early?
I don't know. I don't know what time she went to school, and I don't know what time he noticed all this and he was taking out the trash.
Right. Because, I mean, are we talking about 9 a.m.? Are we talking about 10 a.m.? Are we talking about like 8 in the morning? Like,
yeah.
What's the window here?
That's what I mean. Like, if she's supposed to go to school, she usually is for school at 8 a.m., let's say.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's 7:45 and he's taking out the trash and he notices this and she's not there. It's like, okay, yeah, maybe she went to school early. Fine. But if she goes to school at 8 a.m. and he's taking out the trash at 5 and, like, she's not there, like, then it's a little bit weirder to assume she went to school early, you know?
Right. Also, what did he do with the information that it looked as though somebody had, like, forced entry into the building, not necessarily right. Yasmin's room? What did he do with that information? Did he call PD? Did he make a report?
No, he didn't. So what he did was he called Rose.
Okay.
But he couldn't get in touch with her. So he left her a message asking whether or not she knew where Yasmin had gone, which he said he assumed she was at school.
Okay, hold up. This is what he said in some sort of...
Yeah.
Like, so he said, was it in a voicemail or something?
Yeah, he left her a voicemail.
Left her a voicemail and said, do you know where Yasmin is?
Mm-hmm.
He made a statement previous to that saying, oh, yeah, like, there were signs of forced entry into the building, but, you know, like, Yasmin's room was fine, so I didn't think anything of it.
Right.
But then he specifically called and said, "Where do you know where Yasmin is?"
Yeah, no, I know. And so part of the reason why the only reason why I hesitate to, like, give this a lot of weight is simply because we're getting this from news reports and not, like, a direct, like, report of his statement.
That's fair.
And so it is possible that something could have been misreported along the way.
That's fair.
You know, especially because we're talking about an old case, many different reporters, many different writers. And so I don't want to put too much weight on that, even though, yes, I agree, it is weird.
Which, yeah, it's just it doesn't add up, but you're right. We're talking about multiple reports from different sources and
yeah,
not and we've directly seen from him. And
many yes. times things get lost in translation.
Fair. That's fair.
He left this message or whatever, and Rose later said that her phone wasn't working properly, and so she neither received the call or the message that day. So she says she didn't know about any of this. So she's, like, ending her trip to see her daughter as normal. She, like, went to the store. She stopped on her way back. Oh, so that's the thing. She won $6,000 at the casino. And so she, like, went shopping. She went to lunch at Olive Garden. You know, she kind of did all this stuff as she was making her way back home because she didn't know about any of this. So she wasn't rushing home. She wasn't thinking that, like, anything was wrong at all. So she gets home later that day. And for Charles's part, when he couldn't get a hold of Rose, he was like, well, if Rose isn't, you know, calling me, freaking out, you know, or whatever, I guess he just assumed that Yasmin had left for school. Somebody had then broken in the meantime, and everything was fine. So he just, like, went to work and continued on his day.
I'm having a real hard time with this. This seems like a forced alibi.
Yeah, I don't know. It does seem very weird. I agree.
I'm sorry to everybody involved, but this legitimately seems like a forced alibi, as though this were something planned.
Again, Rose didn't know anything about this. When she got back that day, which I think late afternoon or early evening we're talking about now, Charles told her that the basement had been broken into. Now, break-ins, I guess, were pretty common in the area. So when Rose was told this, she just asked Charles to fix the door.
Okay. So again, nobody reported this to PD. This is, again, this is fitting in with what would be considered a forced alibi, because it's like, oh, this is totally normal, quote unquote normal. I don't buy it. I'm sorry. I don't buy it at this point. If something progresses as you tell me the story, I will backtrack. But at this point, like, no, I'm sorry. Like, Rose and Charles, suspects number one and number two, they're involved in some way.
Well, according to them, at this point, when she gets home and she asks Charles to fix the door, They're both still assuming that Yasmin is at school, and so they don't realize that they were tampering with the potential crime scene by fixing the door.
What time of day was this?
So this is like late afternoon, early evening. So sometimes she would go to school and then like go to the Y, you know, she would do stuff after. So at this point, it's within the time frame that she would potentially be gone.
It's 2008.
Yeah.
Yasmin doesn't have a cell phone?
No, it doesn't sound like it. I've never heard any mention of her having a cell phone. But by 5 p.m., so that's kind of where we are. So we're now at 5 p.m., Yasmin still hadn't made it home. Now at this point, Rose remembered that Yasmin actually had another half day at school that day. So she should have been home earlier. But again, you know, the thing that I found weird about this too was like the day before she had a half day and she went to the Y. And so it's like, why would Rose just not assume that that's where she was on this day either, you know? And like, why would she not check there? And maybe she did check there. I don't know. But at 5:31, she called the police. She then called several more times before the police finally arrived at 7:04.
Okay.
And we know these times because of dispatch logs.
Yeah, sure.
Now, Yasmin had no history of being a runaway and had shown no signs of wanting to do so at any point leading up to her disappearance. But when the police showed up to investigate the scene, they came up with a different conclusion. As we've seen so many times before, police told Rose that Yasmin had most likely run away and would probably show up sooner rather than later.
Ignoring the forced entry.
Yes.
Or maybe that wasn't brought up too.
No, it was. It was brought up.
Okay. Wait a minute. So it was brought up to the officers on scene?
Yeah. And they like, it sounds like they went into the basement, into her room to take a look around.
But they're ignoring the fact that there was forced entry on two different doors. You've
right,
got
a gate
you,
and a door.
You have
yeah.
a gate that leads to a door, and then there is forced entry into that door.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're just like, oh, well, there isn't signs of forced entry into whatever fucking janky room or whatever she was staying in. Like,
right.
So I guess she just left on her own. Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah, I mean, it gets worse.
Jesus Christ.
According to Rose, like when they said that, you know, oh, she'll be back sooner rather than later, she was like, no, you're making assumptions without looking at the evidence. So Yasmin wore glasses and like she could barely see without them. Her glasses were still in the room. Her clothes were still there and there had been a break-in. I mean,
yeah,
hi.
No shit. I'm still not convinced that Rose is innocent in this at this point, but
yeah.
Keep going.
But yeah, so despite all of this, the investigators disagreed with Rose's analysis of the scene. They took no forensic evidence, nor did they dust the locks for prints. They even left both locks at the scene.
Why?
Because they didn't think they had a crime to investigate. So why would they take anything?
You have a fucking child that's missing.
Yeah, she left.
Oh, my God. I mean, just the level. How many levels do we have to go through where it's failure after failure after failure? Holy shit.
Yeah, a lot. I mean, because it doesn't like, stop. So, like...
Oh, don't tell me more.
So, and this is weird. I just don't even understand the point of this next part. In the first few days after her disappearance, like apparently police did go to her school and interview like her friends, I guess.
To try and get some sort of base timeline as to who was the last person that saw her.
I don't think it was maybe? Even that. I think it was more like, hey, did she tell you she was going to run away? But some of her friends at school or classmates or whomever said that, yeah. She had called them and said that she had, in fact, run away.
Bullshit.
Well, yes, of course it was bullshit. Like, and this is the thing. This is the thing. I don't know where the bullshit lies on it. Because the story is that, later reviews of phone records showed that these kids had received no such calls. And then the students eventually admitted that they had made the story up. I don't know that they even said it in the first place, though, because, like, to be quite honest, the way that this investigation had gone, I have a hard time believing that police even would go and take the extra step of looking into these random kids' cell phone records.
100%. There is zero fucking chance that if these police officers or detectives or whatever are going with the theory that she walked out and they're pushing that, they're not going to go to any lengths to interview other kids and say, and get their statements like bolstering that. They're just going to make that shit up. That's bullshit. That's bullshit across the board.
I have a tendency, and I've said this before on the show, that I kind of try to like look at these cases linearly so that I can kind of make sense of the timeline.
Yes.
And so,
well, that's what you're supposed to do.
Right. Well, and so obviously in the timeline, right, like this comes up first where you read in like a newspaper article that these kids said this, and then further investigation into their cell phone records proved that it was not true. And it's like, okay, that happens sometimes, right? Like,
sure, kids say shit.
Yeah, and police look into cell phone records. Like, both of these things happen. Like, these are things that could be true, right? But then as I kind of got into it more, and we skip ahead to 2011, which, you know, we'll get to in a minute, obviously, and we learn more about the investigation or lack thereof, like, it makes this claim even more dubious. Like, I cannot believe that they looked at anybody else's cell phone records based on what we find out in 2011. So, okay, getting ahead of myself.
Okay.
A full 3 days after Yasmin was first reported as missing, the police returned to the home to finally collect the locks and dust them for prints.
How many days?
Three.
Okay. 3 days later, has Charles repaired the door?
I think he repaired the door before cops are even called. I think the door had already been repaired.
Evidence of forced entry would then suddenly be gone.
Right. Or repaired.
Well, right. You know, well, like, that's what I mean.
Like, I don't know how good of a job he did.
Sure. But like, would there be specific striations of crowbar entry, or right. is it like a dent in the doorway from a foot?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something you might not have been able to tell at that point.
Right. Did the frame of the door get broken at all? Like, what level of forced entry are we talking about? All of these things matter.
And depending on how good of a job he did fixing it, I mean,
it's all gone.
It's all gone. And, you know, what level would just be based on his observations, right? Yes. I mean, basically, yes, what he told them.
Exactly.
Like, the doorframe was splintered. I had to do this and that and the other to fix it, you know?
Right.
At this point, they also discovered, and I don't know how this came about. I mean, the most likely scenario would be that, like, in the days leading up to this, Rose was like looking through Yasmin's room to see if, you know, to see what was missing. Or it could have been like on that day when the police came back, they're like, hey, can you look through this and see what's missing? But regardless, at some point, they kind of figured out that out of all of her personal items, the only things that they could really determine that were missing were her pajamas, her coat, and her boots. And again, they still found no sign of a struggle and did not believe that one had occurred.
Okay, so my next question into the investigation, presumably Yasmin does not have a cell phone.
Right. I've never heard anything about a cell phone.
Phone records from her room, from any phone line tying Yasmin to a phone line.
I don't know. The like, only thing like that
does,
I read.
Does she have her own phone line down in the basement? Right.
Yeah, I have no idea.
And if she does, phone records for that. Who was she calling? Who was calling her?
I mean, the only thing I ever read about phone records were getting from the kids, but I don't think that's real, you know, and you would have to assume that the phones were checked, but you can't really assume anything in this case. So who knows? So, but getting back to this, like when the cops come back 3 days later, they finally take the locks, they dust for prints. They discover that her coat, boots, and pajamas are missing. Now, there are a couple ways you can look at this, right? One is that she left willingly. She, you know, had gone downstairs. She was either getting ready for bed or she was already asleep. Then someone came and she decided to leave, putting on her boots and her coat. However, she was only planning on being gone for a short period of time. So she didn't feel the need to change, number one, or take her glasses or any of her other belongings with her. However, the cut lock on the gate and the broken basement door seemed to indicate that this maybe wasn't a planned rendezvous. Yasmin could have still been coerced into leaving, potentially at gunpoint, which would explain the lack of a visible struggle.
That's a leap to say gunpoint, but sure.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be gunpoint, but to me, the cut lock on the gate and breaking down the door from, you know, which is what it sounds like, right? That doesn't tell me that it's like a boyfriend coming to like see you in the middle of the night.
No, no, not at all. And that's not what I'm saying. But like, so what if Terrell came and like broke into the house? And we still don't know the layout of the door versus where Yasmin's sleeping quarters, because we don't even know that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know where that is. So what if he cut the lock, came in, broke the door down, then just gingerly knocked on the door of wherever Yasmin was sleeping or whatever, and
yeah,
was like, hey, let's go have a chat.
Yeah.
It could have been something as simple as that.
Absolutely.
So I would just say it's a leap to get to the point of at gunpoint.
I think it is a leap to get at gunpoint, but the reason I say that, for a few reasons. Like, one is that I think that if it were just a random stranger who had come in, I feel like they would have made more of like, there would have been more of a ruckus. Well, you know what I mean?
No, I agree with you. Look, I don't think this is random.
Yeah.
I don't think it's random. Somebody random off the street is like, you know, cutting the lock, breaking the door down, going into this apartment building and doing literally nothing other than abducting Yasmin.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was completely 100% targeted. There's no other, there's no robbery. There's no, right. there's nothing else missing from the apartment building. If you're making the effort of doing these things, let's say a complete fucking random robber or whatever is cutting the lock, breaking the door down, going into this building, thinking that they're going to steal some shit. And literally the only thing they take out of that building is a human being. None of that fucking adds up.
Well, and especially like if that's what you're doing, if you're just like some random psychopath and you're thinking, okay, let's say I'm not trying to rob, I'm trying to abduct a person. I'm going to let her get her coat and her boots.
Exactly. None of it adds up. This was 100% targeted at getting Yasmin.
Yeah. Like specifically her.
Yes.
Like somebody knew she was sleeping down there.
Yes. And knew that once they were face to face with her, they could convince her to leave on her own. That's where the evidence points.
Yeah.
It doesn't point anywhere else.
Like I said, they did come back and they got, you know, the prints off of the lock, or they took prints. I don't know if they even found any prints, because that's the thing. We've never heard if they actually got anything off of any of that, if there was any usable evidence whatsoever. But whatever they did or they didn't pull from that, the case went cold.
Well, immediately. Of course it's going to fucking go cold because nobody's actually investigating it.
So like straight up, nothing happened. And police never investigated enough to even find out that Terrell had lived in the building.
They didn't even know Terrell lived there before?
Nope.
Holy shit. I mean, come on. Your number one suspect is right there.
Yeah, they never investigated into who had lived there at the time that...
That's one question.
Yasmin.
That's one fucking question. Who else lives in this building?
Yeah, and he didn't live there at the time.
who has lived in this building? Like, oh my God.
Yeah, because what I'm not sure about is whether or not Jimmy, his dad, still lived there. Because Jimmy lived there prior to Terrell living there. That's why Terrell came to the building.
Sure.
And then Terrell moved out. I don't know if Jimmy moved out or if he was still living there. And he was also an ex-con, by the way.
Once again, who lives in this building?
Yeah.
Who has lived in this building since she's been living here? Because it's not, you're not talking about a long period of time when Yasmin was living there, right?
We are. I mean, it's about 7 years. So she came to live there in 2001. This is 2008.
That's still not a long period of time.
Yeah, I don't think there were, like, you know, hundreds of people who had come in and out of this building.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, you want to get a suspect list? Who has lived in the building since Yasmin's been there?
Yeah, it's probably the front of one page. I mean, it's not like...
That's what I'm saying.
Right, like, yeah. No, I know. So they didn't know. But to be fair, Rose also never volunteered that information either. She told the Tribune in 2011 that even though Terrell immediately came to mind after her daughter went missing, she didn't tell police about him because she was afraid of falsely accusing him. I should also mention that the Chicago Tribune article that I've referenced a few times already was written because their reporters did their own investigation and found Yasmin's diary, which was still in her room 2 years after her disappearance.
Okay. What do we get from that?
Well, in it, she talks about, you know, a lot of things. It's a diary.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Among those are her feelings for Terrell and other potentially relevant and important thoughts and feelings. All right. So this is 2011. Okay. Now, police did apparently find out about Terrell having lived in the building in 2009, about a year after Yasmin went missing, because that is when Rose told them about that. And I'll get into why she told them a year later in a second. But it doesn't appear as though between 2009 and 2011, they actually did anything with this information. And the diary, which had just been sitting in her room, had never been found and had never been looked through until a reporter went and saw it.
This is the fundamental issue that I have with this case, is 2008, this girl goes missing. They did no investigation behind any of it. They're just like, she'll come back on her own. We don't need to do anything with this. Despite the fact that there's evidence of forced entry, even if the forced entry into the building itself was repaired, there's still forced entry into the garden or the backyard or whatever. There's still evidence that there was something happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't ask who has lived in the building.
Right.
They didn't look around Yasmin's room. This diary was just sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
You have a 15-year-old girl that went missing. You're the investigator on the case. Even if you're a fucking uniformed officer, you're not going to look around her room?
Yeah, and that's what's wild is that, like, so they came back 3 days after her disappearance and did look around her room, and that's how they figured out, you know, the coat and the boots were missing, but, like, didn't see her diary? And at no point in the intervening two, and it's 2+ years, I mean, 2.5 years, whatever it was, Rose also never looked to see if she could figure anything out? I know I'm kind of, like, hopping back and forth a little bit.
Sure.
So let's go back to 2009.
Okay.
And... This is one year after
yeah. she's been missing.
Right. And so Rose and West Side minister and Yasmin's cousin, Reverend Ira Acree, held a prayer vigil on Yasmin's birthday. And this is something that they would end up doing every year. And they went public, you know, in this first one with their disappointment at how the case had been handled. And they maintained that Yasmin was only considered to be a runaway because of her race. Because there's no actual evidence that said that she was a runaway at all. Like, nothing at all.
No, quite the contrary. The evidence
pointed in the exact opposite direction.
The opposite, yes.
Very valid point. Now, police officials obviously did not take kindly to this criticism, but an internal investigation was launched.
By whom?
by the Internal Affairs Division.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
I'm curious to where that ends because, like, who the fuck cares?
Well, yeah, this is where it ended. In a letter addressed to Rose dated August 30th, 2009, investigators said that after a, quote, thorough investigation of your allegation of misconduct by a member of the Chicago Police Department, all available evidence was evaluated, and it has been determined that misconduct on the part of department members, in parentheses, has been proven, end quote.
Misconduct has been proven?
Yes. So they admitted to misconduct.
Okay.
In August of 2009, and a sergeant and two officers were reportedly punished without the Chicago PD publicly stating what they did wrong or what discipline they received.
This is why IAB is such fucking bullshit.
They also continued to claim that the initial mistakes had, quote, no impact on the investigation.
No impact. Nobody looked into this girl being abducted, but yeah, no, it's totally fine. Everything's fine.
So let's get back to Terrell. We already talked about how he didn't stay out of trouble when he was on parole for that attempted murder when he was released in 2005.
Right.
But his criminal activities became much darker than dealing drugs. On May 9th, 2009, Terrell was arrested for raping five females, including two 14-year-old girls that he is alleged to have kidnapped.
In between her going missing and May 2009, so a year and a half,
yeah,
he has raped
five females. And we say females because two of them were children. Two of them were 14-year-old girls.
Two of which were 14-year-old girls. And Yasmin was 15.
Correct.
When she went missing.
Yeah, and so this arrest is apparently what led Rose to contact police and tell them about Terrell. So this is how police initially found out about Terrell, a year and a half almost after Yasmin's disappearance.
Because nobody asked who has lived in the building while Yasmin has been living there.
Correct. But it also doesn't seem as though much happened between that phone call from Rose and 2011 when this Chicago Tribune article comes out. Oh, he was also arrested for attempted murder at this time as well. In any case, over the next 18 months, as Terrell remained incarcerated in Cook County Jail awaiting trial, police did interview him twice. Now, what remains unclear is whether they were prompted to do this by Rose's information or the tips given to them by the Tribune. Because I don't know exactly when during that period they interviewed him, because the Tribune was also talking to him while he was in jail. While Chicago PD seemed content to let Yasmin's case remain closed, the Tribune started digging. And they found the diary that I mentioned and started to write Terrell in jail. They eventually interviewed him three times. In one interview, he told them, the paper, quote, I know what happened to her, end quote. And this is wild. According to his statement, Yasmin had wanted to commit suicide and he had simply helped her.
What?
He claimed to have taken her to another house on the 2200 block of South Spalding where he'd burned her body in a garbage can.
Prove it.
Well, exactly, right? He also said that he was responsible for the murders of three other women and a man for which he had never been charged.
Okay, so now he's just inflating his own.
Right. And this is kind of what the reporters are thinking. So they're like, prove it. Just like you said, you know, like give us some evidence.
You can't just burn a body and suddenly the body's gone. We've all watched Making a Murderer. Like, you can't just like burn a body completely.
Yeah.
It's just like there's trace evidence. There's things that will be there.
Sure. But only if somebody looks.
Sure. But also not in Chicago.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, you would have to have that fire stoked for a real fucking long time to burn bones and hair and everything. and for nobody to notice in an urban environment.
So, all right. So they asked him to, you know, give them some evidence. And he said that he had hidden some photo negatives in an attic vent at a former girlfriend's house on Chicago's South Side. He also said that he had left a, quote, tether in the backyard that could be used for a person.
What the hell does that mean?
Well, they didn't know. So they went to the house, which was empty due to foreclosure. And while they were poking around, they saw a dog tether in the backyard.
What's a dog tether?
It's like, you know, when you chain your dog up, like outside. It's like something like that.
So he's saying that he chained somebody up outside?
Yeah, or maybe. Or that he, like, used that chain or, you know, rope or, like, whatever it was to restrain a person.
Okay.
So these reporters are going to this house because this guy in prison who's been in prison for attempted murder twice now, this is his second attempted murder charge, you know, and the rape of five people, like, it's like, hey, yeah, I put some negatives in the attic and I left a tether in the backyard. They go to the house, they find a tether in the backyard. So they're like, you know what? We're good. We're not, like,
let's call Chicago PD.
Yeah, exactly. So they did, and Chicago PD secured a search warrant. And then on March 4th, searched the property. Now, they left with that tether and several evidence bags, but declined to provide any more information about what was found. So we don't know if there were negatives in an attic vent and what they may have shown. We don't know anything about what else they found other than the tether, which, you know, reporters could obviously just clearly see them pick up. Now, while we don't know what was found, we do know that Terrell was never charged with any crime related to Yasmin. Also, for the record, Yasmin's family does not believe she died by suicide or that Terrell helped her with this plan. They do, however, believe that he was involved with her disappearance and death. Jimmy Terrell Smith was sentenced to 110 years in prison for the five rapes, all of which took place, again, between 2006 and 2009. And to make it extra clear, that would place Yasmin's disappearance firmly in the time span that Terrell was actively engaging in criminal sexual activity, including the raping and kidnapping of two 14-year-old girls. I would be interested to know the circumstances around those crimes, right? Like, was there forced entry in any of those, or were these people that Terrell knew and coerced into coming with him voluntarily? Like, what were the circumstances, right? In the years that followed Yasmin's disappearance, Rose organized and led many marches, vigils, and press conferences trying to raise awareness for Yasmin's case. She also reportedly fell into a severe depression that deeply impacted her health. But speaking at a rally in 2011, Rose said, quote, "It's been 4 years. It's been hard. It's been rough. Yasmin, if you can hear us, we love you and we do miss you and we're doing our best to get you back," end quote. In February 2014, Rose was found dead in her apartment at the age of 57.
Do we know why? How?
Her death was ruled as a result of natural causes stemming from the ongoing health issues she'd been suffering from since Yasmin's disappearance.
That doesn't make any fucking sense.
After this whole Chicago Tribune interview, you know, thing in 2011, Terrell never admitted to any further involvement in Yasmin's case, and he also died of natural causes in 2014 while still in prison. Rose's death and the lack of answers in Yasmin's case didn't mean that Yasmin's family would give up on getting answers. As the 10-year anniversary of Yasmin's disappearance approached in 2018, her cousin, Reverend Ira Acree, was joined by other family members at his church for a memorial event. During this event, Reverend Acree did most of the speaking and covered various elements of Yasmin's case, including the police misconduct and the unused confession from Terrell. He also called on Cook County's new state's attorney, Kim Fox, to reopen the case. Acree said, quote, "I couldn't in my heart of hearts rally up a group of people one more time to say, let's disperse some flyers in the neighborhood, because the truth of the matter is we've done that, and we already know somebody knows something. We are here basically saying we need the media's help, but we also want, number one, for the Chicago Police Department to do their job," end quote. On October 25th, 2021, on Yasmin's 29th birthday, Reverend Decree wrote a post on austintalks.org. In it, he once again lamented the lack of answers in his cousin's case, along with the lack of effort on the part of Chicago police, saying, quote, "Since the death of Starnes, the Chicago Police Department has allowed it to become a cold case, and they no longer respond when family members inquire about the case," end quote. But Reverend Decree has proven that the death of Rose didn't mark the death of people caring about Yasmin's case. She still has people out there who love her. He goes on to say, quote, "The legal system needs to right this wrong. 4 superintendents later, and the Chicago Police Department has shamefully not given her case its much-needed proper attention. I have no idea what they could possibly be hiding, but Yasmin deserves justice and is entitled to having her voice heard. We will not go away quietly, and we will not rest until we have answers," end quote. Yasmin Rayon Decree has been missing from Chicago, Illinois since January 16, 2008. Yasmin is a Black female with sandy brown hair and brown eyes. She was 5'1" and approximately 125 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She was 15 when she went missing. She would be 30 today. Anyone with information on the disappearance of Yasmin Decree is asked to contact Chicago Police at 312-744-8266. Or the FBI. There's a $10,000 reward in this case. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. Research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Additional research for this episode is provided by Nikki Elmas. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why MyLowe's Rewards members get a free paint or exterior stain sample to test your look and find the perfect color to confidently refresh your space. Lowe's, we help, you save. Offer valid in-store only, 5/8 through 5/14. Limit 1 per customer while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See associate for details. Program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.